Okay, this is the April 6th Statutory Interpretation and Regulatory Practice class, and we are at a watershed. We have finally now officially left behind statutory interpretation. It is in the rearview mirror. I have no recap to offer you on all the things we've covered on canons, legislative history, extraneous materials, extrinsic materials, excuse me, that you can use to interpret a statute. I will sort of open up for just one window here any and all questions that may have come to your mind as you're preparing your outlines for finals, which many of you know are doing, or after your experience with a midterm. So any last questions, statutory interpretation before we turn to our last monolithic part of the class? Everyone's got it totally synthesized, completely cool with this. You live and breathe and use this stuff in all your other classes. Okay. All right, in all seriousness, if you have any other questions, raise your hand, let me know, or come by at night, office hours tomorrow afternoon. So we are actually now moving to a part of the class which I can probably comfortably predict 95% of you are going to hit smack head on as soon as you graduate. We're now talking about administrative practice. This is the regulatory practice part of the class. So with that in mind, I just want to say, let's start with the basics. I know a lot of times I tend to depart a little bit from the reading because I want you to not get locked in strictly to what you're being fed in the text, but use your heads, use your brains. Let's just start with some fundamentals here. We've gone through the hard work of the legislative process. We've learned about legislative practice. We've learned how to interpret statutes. Now we've got one. Now, what I want to present to you now is, what do you do next? How do you implement a statute? What are the tools you have in hand? Now, so with that in hand, go just offhand, pick this topic for a statute. What's something you care about? And it can't be law school grades. For some reason, all of our reading bench is on this side of the room, so I'm going to turn to this side of the room as a result. This is free play. No responsibilities. What's a topic that you would want to have a statute on? It can be anything from hunting to corporate transactions, pharmaceuticals, campaigns. So you can't resist, even though it's on the other side of the room.
It's hard.
And this isn't something Professor Turner is talking about in his class by any chance. Okay, so I'll make sure. Okay, campaign contributions. Leaving aside all constitutional law, I just want to ask the practical problem. What do we want to say about campaign contributions? I said we wanted to say contributions by corporations are hereby capped at a total amount of $5 million a year. Okay? How do you enforce that? You have that statute. What are the tools you have before you? How are you going to get, what's the model of it? I was going to say IBM because they've always been the model of it, but I can say Apple probably is the one that says. How do you keep Apple from spending whatever they want to, assuming constitutional inhibitions don't want to?
You have to hire somebody to look up how much money you donate.
Okay.
And doesn't the IRS or somebody record how much money they donate?
So we have to have a reporting function. There's a transparency function. You're collecting the information. You've now discovered that Apple has contributed $1 billion. Now what? What are the tools you want to have in the statute to make it enforceable? And who's going to do it?
I would assume that I'm guessing.
Of course, you're guessing because this is total free play.
Well, I would just think that we have a government agency that would have authority to to regulate that and to proceed and to put rules out for and guidelines and all of that. But it just seems like it'd be a little more efficient.
Well, that's usually the default answer, he says. But why? Why have an agency?
Because it can be more efficient if a government agency has power to set guidelines and rules, and now we have it established enough at least with the, I think it was APA guidelines, but like we have it established enough with guidelines that the public can respond to rules, so it can be at least somewhat fair. And it seems like an easy way to get it, or a practical way to get it enforced.
Fair, easy, practical.
I think the biggest thing is practical.
Okay. All right. So in the bottom line, then it would work if you did that, right?
Yeah, and I don't think the alternatives, what else would you do? Like, I just think
Let's ask some of your silent compatriots in this side of the room. If you couldn't create an agency, if you wouldn't create an agency, what else could you do to enforce the limit on the end contributions? For what?
Violating the statute.
And what would happen to them if you won?
Whatever, I guess, is in the statute, but as far as punishment is concerned.
Well, who is taking them to court?
Well, that's the problem, because there's no injured person in, I mean, we're all injured by it, but there's no, like, specific injured person in it, but who can sue and say, I was personally affected by...
I didn't know if you heard of Beats Sotovace comment down there, he said, campaign opponent.
I guess that's true. But still, like...
That's a good point, you should speak more loudly. I'm sorry, keep going.
It's hard to say I was personally injured by the fact that Apple gave this guy $10 billion. Mm-hmm. So...
Okay, so what it sounds like then is you're talking about a citizen, an individual in a private capacity bringing a lawsuit authorized by the statute to do so. And of course, you pointed to a fundamental problem with any citizen suit statute. If it's in federal court, it's in a federal Article III court, you've got to meet Article III standing irreducible requirements, which I know Professor Turner's talking to you about that, right? Probably excruciatingly detailed discussion of that. Don't tell myself that. All right, so I will simply say be careful. You're pressing one of my big red buttons because citizen suits are one of the mainstays of environmental enforcement. Essentially, a lot of statutes say we don't need EPA. We don't need to have any other enforcement mechanism. We are going to say citizens have the right to sue as if they were the government. But they have the Article 3 problems. How do you prove you've been injured by a release of the environment? But besides, that's an excellent point. That's one. So we've had one, citizens can sue if they're empowered by the statute to basically act as the government. And hopefully not stretching your comments too much there, but said. Okay. We've had two, create an agency. Fair, free, fair, efficient, transparent, and solid by the statute. Anything else? I'll give a big fat hint. Yeah. What way, Ryan?
Criminal.
Who said that? Don? Or? Okay. You're both getting
practice. She said police and I said criminal, so it's one and the same, basically.
All right, sort of a photo finish right at the line. Okay. Criminal. Why bother with agencies if you can have someone go directly to jail, do not pass go, do not collect $200, you're logging significant time behind bars. The orange jumpsuit is a very powerful motivator. I ask these questions because I think in fairness, I do the same thing. Our default response anytime a complex modern statute is written now is create an agency to implement. But there have been alternative approaches where an agency is not necessarily an integral part of the equation. Or there are different ways the agency can be incorporated in, so you don't have to have the elaborate superstructure associated with an agency. Don't forget civil liability. Don't forget criminal liability. Don't forget the ability of the state or citizens to directly take the stick to the violator as a way to encourage behavior. Having said that, now we have to sort of ask the next question. You're absolutely correct. Thank you. I will go with, now our default answer, we decide to create an agency. I'm going to ask the unfair question, and this is not just a mishap, it's to everybody. What the hell is an agency? And saying, you know it when you see it, the pornography answer will not be good enough. What's a workable definition of an agency?
A unit of government created by Congress through statutes and given considerable powers to implement public policy that Congress has set forth in legislation.
And that was read so beautifully. Where were you reading it from? And where in the book, so everyone will have it?
It's under the preliminary taxonomy of federal agencies.
So, not a case, not a decision by federal court. This is Professor Eskridge's working definition of what an agency is.
Yes.
So basically, you think it's right because someone in a wood panel office in Yale says it's so.
Yes.
Wow, professors have so much power. This is so cool. All right, let's start then. Examples of agencies.
FDA.
Sorry,
the
what?
The FDA.
FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration. All right. What about the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals?
No.
Why not?
They're a court.
Read your definition. Is it a unit of government?
Implement public policy, though. I don't know if a court is supposed to implement public policy.
What's enforcement of the statute or interpretation of common law other than promotion of public policy?
Someone to court and the court tells you this is what the law is, not this is the public policy behind the law.
Okay, so if a court, say, for example, just making something up, the U.S. Supreme Court decides to do something like write the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, is it an agency? It's writing a rule. They're being subjected to Congress for approval. Okay. All right. Just out of curiosity, save that. I will come back. I promise. It's a slightly unfair question, but I think a question that we need to wrestle with, perhaps. Any other agency examples? We've had the FDA. Any other agencies?
Federal Trade Commission.
Okay. Is there any difference between the FDA and the FTC in your opinion?
The jurisdiction they have to set what they're allowed, the subject matter that they're allowed to implement policies and guidelines and advice about.
Okay.
So,
roughly the same.
They might have different powers that they're allowed to use too, but I'm not sure the specifics of those.
Okay. All right. Well, let me give a few other examples, and I'll throw the questions into the ball now. And you're absolutely right, but discount. What about the Department of Justice? Is that an agency? I see some people going, it's interesting. They're not saying yes. They're not saying no. They're kind of going, well, for those who listen to reporting, I put my head side to side, which, by the way, is a very Indian custom, by the way. If you ask someone a hard question, they'll kind of go like that. Okay. So anyway, Dixon, Chris, would you, were you also having an opinion on this one, Department of Justice? Okay.
I really don't know.
But you look so interested. I thought you might have had something there. So just tell me off the top of your head, is Department of Justice an agency based on the definition Sarah read out?
Yes.
Why?
I think so. It's created by the government, deals with public policy, and implements law.
Okay. What about the Department of War, Department of Defense?
According to the definition, I would say so too.
Even it's rooted in the Constitution, was one of the very first things created in the government by George Washington. All right, okay. Is everyone sort of agreeing that we get to even the big agencies, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, Department of Health and Human Services? People are comfortable saying those are agencies. It's just courts were kind of going, maybe not. All right, let me sort of pursue it further. We're talking about what an agency is. First, let me give you a cheat sheet. And this is one that's so easy for everyone to ignore. It's actually in front of you. Appendix C of your book. For those of you who want to leaf to it, we're talking about the Administrative Procedure Act, which we'll spend a little bit more time at the end of class. But it actually gives you the functional, current, legal definition of agency under federal law. And believe me, this is one of those rare times the appendix is actually worth reading or taking a look at. Now, I will confess to you, the Administrative Procedure Act is not exciting reading, but it is something you will find yourself coming to again and again. It is the touchstone of administrative law on the federal level. We'll talk a little bit more about how it's structured and what it means, but the key thing about the Administrative Procedure Act is that it really kind of sets some of our working assumptions on what is and is not agency, what is and is not action, what is and is not formal or informal. So your book, and here we're getting to the part of the class which I'm sort of reminded of the old Russian fable about the sleigh that was being chased by wolves, and the wolves were gaining more and more, and they started throwing out things in the sleigh, the seats, the hay, and then they started looking at each other and started tossing members of the sleigh party out to the wolves. I am now tossing things out of the sleigh for you guys, and I do it with a heavy heart. As a result, today I'm going to talk about some things that are not your assigned reading, but I at least want you to know they are there, because they will be relevant to you, important to you as you practice in an environmental arena at some point in the future. And I've said this before, but I think no matter what you want to do, if it's corporate, if it's criminal, if it's immigration, if it is anything, if even tort law, you're going to be in front of an agency. So everything we're talking about, I know, may sound a little bit abstract, but I guarantee you, you will be looking, you'll be raising Chevron at some point in your career fairly soon. So with that in mind, we are not going to talk about the reading of the book about the history and rise of the administrative state. It is my deep and fondest hope you've already had this discussion. In particular, in your con law class, talking about the question of separation of powers and delegation doctrines. And I'll pause here. Have y'all talked about your con law class? No? The New Deal, the rise of administrative agencies after the Great Depression. You're giving me comfort and hope, yes? You've talked about the con law, or you actually know about it from other sources?
We talked about the non-delegation.
Okay. So did y'all actually read American Trucking Association versus Whitman?
I'm not sure which case it is. That was kind of interested during the New Deal and then after the New Deal.
Okay.
How the court viewed agencies. But we didn't focus on agencies in particular. It was more like
what
the
court
was saying, I guess.
Okay. Well, then... let me so take some mild comfort then that I'm not leaving you ill-equipped to deal with the world outside. I will simply say the reading on the rise of administrative state is worth your time. I will simply note that the takeaways from that are that agencies are not a new invention. Agencies have been around since the creation of the United States. Some of the first governmental actions were the creations of departments that were effectively agencies. But agencies have come more recently into a much more prominent role as a consequence of the New Deal in response to the Great Depression, where agencies have risen to play a central role in the regulation of virtually every major economic activity as part of American life. That rise of the role of agencies as a sort of quasi-arm of the government in turn evoked a series of constitutional issues, including striking down of important agencies during the New Deal. I think at this point, I just want to note for you that one way to resolve these concerns, to bring some transparency, fairness, predictability to the administrative law process, was the passage of the Administrative Procedure Act immediately after World War II. So we will not talk as much about constitutional issues. There are two, though, I want to simply flag for you. This is sort of the Russian sleigh moment. Number one, the non-delegation doctrine. The non-delegation doctrine simply says Congress has a limit on the amount of authority it can delegate to an agency to effectively create law. Think about it. Congress can't write a law that says, we hereby create the Department of Extraterrestrial Affairs, and clause two is the Department of Extraterrestrial Affairs will write any and all requirements related to this topic, and they walk away. There has to be some irreducible constitutional minimum on the amount of discretion Congress can delegate to an agency. And usually, though, that irreducible minimum is fairly small. It's essentially an intelligible principle is all it's required. And the American Truck Association versus Whitman case in your textbook is one example of this, but I assume it's also done in your con law classes. I just wanted to remind you that that doctrine is there. There's a reason I haven't asked you to read it. I will simply tell you, bottom line, in practice, it's had relatively little effect. There have been numerous challenges alleging non-delegation doctrine violations. Very few have succeeded in striking down laws unconstitutional, and certainly has not been a dominant role in agency practice. Second, we are not going to talk about constitutional limits on the, we're not going to read about, we will talk about now, the constitutional limits on the ability of the president to fire heads of agencies. Hire and fire is one of the biggest, most powerful tools that any administrator has to make sure an organization runs according to his or her dictates. In our situation, the president actually has authority under Article 2 to remove officers, and that this authority has deep separation of powers roots. At the same time, Congress has the power under Article 1 to create, by legislation, agencies which are, in their very nature, insulated from political interference. How do you balance those two? There has been a series of cases going back, I'd say comfortably at least 80, probably over 100 years, where the seesaw has tilted back and forth. For now, I think the key thing I'll point out is that there are limits on the abilities of Congress to insulate the heads of agencies from presidential removal. But those limits are not so tight that Congress cannot effectively create a brand of agency that is designed to withstand presidential interference and influence. The takeaway here, which we'll talk about in a minute, is that if you take a look, most agencies tend to fall into one of two buckets, either executive agencies or independent agencies. Now, how can you tell the two between the difference? Now here, remember, you've actually read about this already, but as much fun as it would be to sort of try and exhume it from your deep subconscious memories, this is from your first week of class. Take a look at pages 61 and 62 of your textbook. It gives you a very neat bullet point summary of the key differences between executive agencies and independent agencies. Now, if you look at the taxonomy, the way that these two differ structurally, it becomes pretty clear, pretty obvious on how these types of agencies differ in fundamental ways. For example, if you take a look at an executive agency, you'll see some hallmarks that are very clearly immediately different from an independent agency. Executive agencies tend to have one person calling the shots, one administrator, one executive. Independents tend to have multiple commissioners working together as a group, always an odd number. Second, executive agencies tend to serve for the duration of the president's term or at his or her pleasure. Independent agencies, the commissioners serve for periods of years, and they can lap between different agencies, different administrations. Also, they tend to serve at staggered terms. So you don't have one board all rotating off at the same time. They all sort of each step off at different points, and you maintain some continuity. Third, executive agencies almost always, very rare exception, are partisan appointments. Independent agencies, often by statutory dictate, are nonpartisan. You can't appoint someone because of their party affiliation. And last, well actually, but one other thing. Executive agencies, basically, when I said you serve at the pleasure of the president, what that really means is that he can or she can yank you at any moment. You don't have to have any reason. You may wear the wrong color tie to the office. The president's authority for the executive agency, at that point, arguably, in political realities it's not true, but generally, as a matter of constitutional administrative analysis, that's all it takes. Independent agencies, you usually have a statutory restriction that can only be removed for cause. Last, you will oftentimes see litigation authority. With an executive agency, usually, if they want to sue somebody, they have to pick up the phone. They have to have the Department of Justice file a lawsuit for them. By contrast, an independent agency oftentimes is vested with the authority to file a lawsuit in its own name. Interesting quirk, but that's one of the most reliable litmus tests to distinguish between the two. That's why you'll see the Department of Justice file a lawsuit on behalf of the Food and Drug Administration. But if the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is an independent agency, decides they want to file a lawsuit, and the Department of Justice says, don't, they have the authority to file. So with those in hand, do those make sense? Any questions about the distinctions between executive and independent agencies? All right. With that in mind, I promised I'd come back to this. Remember I started the class? We had Dr. Moire Rosso coming down to speak with us. Dr. Moire Rosso was the chairman of the U.S. Chemical Safety Board. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board consists of, at the moment, three commissioners. He is the chairman of the board. They have theoretically space for two more appointees. They have the authority to investigate accidents the same way that the NTSB responds to airplane crashes. They are not there to put anyone in jail. They are not there to point the finger of blame with a legal liability associated with it. They're just simply there to find out what happened. So as a result, Deepwater Horizon, Chemical Safety Board was there. The exposure of workers in DuPont's facility and where they had worked three worker fatalities because of exposure to mercaptans right here in this part of the state. They're deeply involved in that. Dr. Rafael Moria Rosso, however, is no longer the chair. He resigned. He resigned even though his term finished, his five-year term, finishes of its own accord in June. Now, I'll pause here. He resigned after, according to press reports, a direct phone call from President Obama to his office. At that point, he gave up the ghost. He'd been under fire from Congress, he'd been under fire from Officer Inspector General, the EPA. I ask you the question then, given the way he responded here, given the way this turned out, and I'll give you more details if you're interested, is the Chemical Safety Board an independent agency or an executive agency? I know it's a good question, but Sarah's furrowing her brow. That's a good sign.
I would say it's independent, right? Because just because the president calls you doesn't mean you have to resign. You got a term of years.
So right.
Just said no, and you kept doing
it. Is that realistic? The president of the United States has called you on your line. Now, remember, he's only been there 5 years, so he was appointed during President Obama's administration. And he said, for the greater good, you need to step down. Is that undue interference with an independent agency, if it's supposed to be independent? And the whole point of setting this up is to keep the president from interfering with its operation.
There's always going to be gray areas where stuff like this comes up. But he still could have said no.
Mm-hmm. And what would have happened if he'd said no?
Whatever the removal process is, would have taken place if they had pulled together at that point. But probably, knowing the government, they would have just waited until June until they had it.
Well, that's true. If the removal process, calling before Congress, having a vote, might have taken more than time yet left. In theory, as well, the executive and the legislative branch could just stopped off. This basically made him a pariah. You know, he calls someone, no one returns the call. He sends an information request, no one sends a response. Again, I'm just sort of pointing out it's easy to have this bright line. I've given this schematic with an easy recipe with five factors. In the real world, there's actually still a lot of room. Jordan?
Yeah, I was just going to say the state came early is positive because we talked about the EEOC, which is basically you pick the term. Only one way or the other, if there's an executive or an independent agency. The only distinction you pointed out was whether or not they could file their own lawsuits, so that would be a question, I guess.
All right. Any other thoughts or comments, real quickly?
Does that happen often, where the president calls and someone who is independent agency?
Extraordinarily rarely. Okay. This is like a once in a generation type
of
event.
So maybe in practice it's not as different as we're saying if this is an on example. Mm-hmm.
Well, and. All right, we're back on the record, and we were talking about the differences between independent and executive agencies, and we're discussing how the Chemical Safety Board was an illustration. I will also say, again, in the Russian sleigh analogy, there's some reading in the book which I intentionally decided not to assign you several weeks ago, and now all of a sudden, current events has made it much more relevant than I thought. On pages 901 through 907, for those of you interested in extra recreational reading, there is a discussion about how federal agencies responded to making pilots' doors on planes protected against intrusion from passengers after 9/11, which seemed to me a fairly interesting but not relevant issue until, of course, the Germanwings crash, where those exact same types of cockpit protections gave the co-pilot allegedly the ability to lock out the pilot. There's no way he could get in time as he pointed the plane down towards the mountains and accelerated downwards. According to the black box, the pilot was trying to open the door with a fire axe as the last seconds of the plane's flight ended. Probably some of the same type of discussions we were talking about in the book on making the cockpit more protected against terrorists had the unintended effect of making that co-pilot invulnerable to attempts to stop him from doing that suicide dive. So for those of you interested in sort of how you strike that balance, how agencies need to sort of figure out and deal with these kinds of horrible situations, that reading is actually rather interesting right now. And I'm glad to talk about it with you if you'd like. It could be something we could add to our Friday session. Okay, so any questions about what is an agency? The Administrative Procedure Act's definition of agency and the difference between independent and executive agencies. All right, because now we're going to sort of get to the grist through the mill today. We're going to talk about essentially what is the mode of operation of agencies. I am concerned here, and I need you guys to keep me honest. This stuff is something I've done so often. I oftentimes have been told by associates at the law firm I was working at that I tended to assume that I told them things or that they knew things that were sort of second nature. So I suspect in our readings already in this class, you've been seeing terms tossed about that we haven't discussed yet. So the key things I'm going to try and do right now is make sure we're all in the same playing field, that we're all at the same starting point at least. What I want to talk about today is in particular the difference between formal rulemaking by agencies, informal rulemaking by agencies, both under the Administrative Procedure Act, and open the very first cracks of the door on judicial review of both of those types of actions. So, with that in mind, the Administrative Procedure Act, remember, Appendix C, is very clear about this. There are two modes of agency operation. One is formal, one is informal. Now, that's a rather anodyne term. It doesn't really tell you a lot what we're talking about. So, as always, it's great to give it an example by going to a case. And here, the book is very gracious in giving us the U.S. versus Florida East Railway Company case. And yes, I'm sure you'll be shocked to see that Rehnquist had written yet another railroad opinion. I think there's something going on there. With that in mind, I guess, you've already done yeoman's duty, Sarah, so I will rotate slowly to the left and Ruben comes into field of view. Thank you for wearing a suit and tie for your reading panel today. There we go. So can you give us a little sense of what the U.S. v. Florida East Railway case is about?
Yes, essentially what happened was the Interstate Commerce Act and the commission. There was a shortage of rail cars, and so to kind of help curtail that, what they decided to do was implement a levy of sorts, against the rental of those freight cars. So with the intent of helping spur, I guess, the production of more freight cars for transportation of goods and such. However, the...
Well, Ruben, could you render that into stupid speak for me?
Yeah.
Levy, what does that mean? Who's paying more? Who's getting more?
Well, essentially, the person renting those freight cars would have to pay a little bit more. At first, it was just, you know, to make a little bit of profit, you know, break even cost, but it was stagnating, I guess, the production of freight cars, and so there was a shortage. And what tended to be only seasonal in the Midwest, during grain productions and such, started becoming a common occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So to help curtail that problem, the commission decided to use their authority in what they saw was just under the amendment of, what was it, 63 or 68, something like that. Sorry, I didn't hear. To kind of, curtail this issue from happening and spur, like I said, the production of more freight cars.
So if I could, you're exactly right to sort of set a little bit of background. Think about railways at that time were actually a fairly limited commodity.
Correct.
The same way we have utility lines, just one going to each of our houses. The ability of a utility to gouge us because they have a monopoly means that the commission, or the agency of some sort, has to set a fair rate. And that fair rate usually is based on the cost we're buying the service plus this reasonable profit. But it was turning out that during peak periods, like harvest time, it wasn't enough. So essentially, when you say levy or surtax, they got who's being able to charge more for what, I guess, is to make sure I understand.
Well, essentially we drive up the cost for those people renting those freight cars.
So,
others.
Farmers.
Correct.
Steermen.
I was going to say, but it gets passed down.
Cattlemen.
You can assume that.
You and me.
Yep.
Okay. All right, and the ones making the money would be?
The railroad companies renting out those freight cars.
Right, railway barons, robber barons, rich people. Okay, so we understand a little bit more of the dynamic, perhaps. Okay, so this is basically surge pricing. To encourage rail cars to be put on the rail, they get to make more money off them. All right, keep going. So what's the legal conundrum here?
Well, the issue was there a hearing behind it? Was there a proper, when the commission made their decision, did they take public comments from these railways? Essentially like a mini trial on the hearings, which, they didn't. They were able to just listen informally, but that's the issue. I lost it here.
Well, while you're looking, let me fold in a question with you there, which is the requirement for the hearing, where is that coming from? Which law?
From the APEA, or the Administrative Procedures Act.
Look carefully at the first footnote in the case. This is one of those ones where they tuck away something where you're least likely to see it.
The Interstate Commerce Act, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then it was amended in 66.
Okay.
So.
And what's the off-bit length we're talking about then from the Interstate Commerce Act? And yes, I'm reluctantly pulling out the old statutory interpretation approach. Read the statute. Well, I'll just throw it out to the class. Page 941, footnote 1. We have the actual language of the statute that's driving the case. Does it say anything about what's required for the Interstate Commerce Commission to set rates? What does it have to do? Is your hand up or are you just stretching? You should know better. And not only that, you're wearing a hat, which makes you a target. Do you have your textbook with you by chance?
No, I don't.
Oh, but she's sliding it helpfully down to you. You know, to use the adapt metaphor, I think she just shoved you in front of the train onto the tracks.
Just, what's the first line of that statutory language? And the footnote.
The commission may, after hearing on a complaint or on its own initiative without a complaint, establish reasonable rules, regulations, and practices with respect to car service by common carrier, by railroads subject to this chapter, including the compensation to be paid and other terms of any contract, agreement, or arrangement for the use of any locomotive, car, or other vehicle not owned by the carrier using it.
Ed, you can stop. That was beautiful. It was almost method acting. I could feel you inhabiting the part and making it part of your personality.
That's great.
All right, but again, does it say anything about what the ICC has to do to set the rate? What sort of process it needs to follow through? I'd like it. Everyone, for those listening on the recording, everyone's making air quotes around the words after hearing. That's it. This whole case is on what does the words after hearing mean in setting rates that allow rail companies to make more money off of their customers in periods of surge pricing. Okay? So how do we fill in meaning to the words after hearing, which is what Rehnquist now devotes multiple pages to. And now I'll circle back on a ribbon. With that context in mind, how does Rehnquist sort of chase this from the ground? I guess, bottom line, you know my favorite question here. Who won?
The commission won.
Okay.
The commission won within their authority. Essentially, they were saying
that. Relevance won.
Correct. So they were saying that the hearing itself wasn't a trial or and such, that they weren't able to factor in the considerations of what was going on to listen, but they didn't have to have a full hearing on it.
So full hearing means oral testimony.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So in this case, then we have, I'm assuming from the description of the case, public notice,
yeah.
Submissions, written testimony, reams of written testimony. Opportunities to submit rebuttal written testimony.
Correct.
And the ICC said we might have a hearing. Request one if so. And people requested, and ICC said, nah, we really don't need a hearing. We've got enough. We're deciding. And Rehnquist thinks that's sufficient.
It was sufficient because they had the opportunity. Once again, as long as they were able to be heard, it didn't mean that the commission had to do a full hearing of trial of sorts. But the fact that they can consider it, they're not bound to have a full hearing on that.
So basically, after hearing in the ICC means basically something a little less than a full trial type advocacy proceeding.
Exactly.
Okay. If this had been under the APA, would that have been the same answer?
Well, is that what the opponents were arguing?
I was going to say, wasn't that the point of the
I mean, there is provisions in the Administrative Procedure Act, particular 556D, which says you can have, coming back to our original introduction to this discussion, formal agency proceedings. Formal is no joke, formal. We're talking about essentially a trial type proceeding with a decision maker hearing evidence submitted with oral testimony, document for rebuttal, to cross-examine witnesses. All of this is laid out in the Administrative Procedure Act. And some agencies still do this. So with that in mind, why did Rehnquist say that the Administrative Procedure Act here didn't dictate that a hearing, after hearing, meant that you had to have oral testimony?
Was that the essentially that after the hearing requirement? Is that what you're talking about? Was essentially a statutory requirement?
I mean,
it would have been the equivalent of a statutory requirement that wasn't there.
Well, basically, we have a words in the statute, the ICC statute, that says after hearing, it says nothing else. If you take a look at what the equivalent would be under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is meant to be the roadmap for agency action, federal level, it requires oral history, oral testimony. Why did Rehnquist say, yeah, well, that's what the APA requires, but we don't need to apply it here? Did he have any kind of rationale? And since you're wearing a tie, you have a one free pass to throw the flaming baton to someone else if you'd like to.
Okay.
All right.
Limit our capabilities. You know, although going back and forth, you know, it confused me. I understand the gist of it, but.
Well, can I offer a suggestion then?
Yeah.
And I'm curious, how many of you else know, Jordan's hand is up. Oh, come on.
I'm sorry? I was going
to answer
the question.
Then answer the question. That'd be fabulous, because I get the feeling people get tired of hearing me give all the answers.
You said that the formal rulemaking requirements are only triggered whenever it says on the record.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? James?
I guess there was a distinction between things which are meant to adjudicate and things which are just kind of basic rule policy making, and if something is meant to be like a blanket rule, then it just covers, if you can't expect something which covers that many people, I guess, to for them to all have an oral hearing of some type.
So this has been an ICC determination that this rail car train in Nebraska with this farm was being charged a fair amount.
Right.
Oral testimony required at that point?
Yeah, if it was particularly, because then you'd be, I guess, curtailing their due process rights, because it's like an individual adjudication as opposed to just a blanket rulemaking situation. So that's what this entire case hinged on, and so they said there wasn't.
Okay. Absolutely. So the nature of the agency action dictates what degree of formality the process it must be accorded. It's your thesis here. And Jordan, would you agree with that too? Since you two together offered a constructive answer together. Yes. In part, there are fundamental attributes of the agency action which dictate which path you might go along. In particular, if you are offering an agency action which is designed to be broadly applicable to everybody, at the same time as well, it's designed to provide a requirement where it would be impractical to have this kind of trial procedure that would apply to this large body of people who are being affected by it. And there's no one who's being uniquely or specially affected by it. At that point, a formal rulemaking procedure doesn't seem to make much sense. And that background colored the way Rehnquist interpreted the words upon hearing in the ICC. Now, having said that, I'll step back and offer two quick thoughts. One thing that's almost a throwaway line, but it's worth flagging in your textbook, Rehnquist does note that the Administrative Procedure Act itself says that it is not designed to supplant or replace other statutes' procedures. It's a default. It's a framework. But if a statute by Congress dictates that a different procedure shall be used, the APA does not override it. Second, ask yourself the question, why would any sane agency ever want to use formal rulemaking? If you're an agency, which would you prefer? Informal rulemaking, which we'll talk about in a minute, I'll tell you, is much easier and much tilted in favor of the agency, including in particular the standard of review. With that in mind, I'll simply note in passing that, yes, drawing this line makes it difficult to say when an agency is required to use formal rulemaking. But the bottom line as well is that as a result, very few agency actions are done in this type of way anymore. The overwhelming majority of activities by agencies is informal rulemaking. We're about now to go to our last case. We're going to talk about exactly how that works with the exciting issue of baked whitefish. This is one, though, where actually their passion lurks beneath the surface. Before we do, let me say one thing, and I know just as much as I say who won is my favorite question, this one is also one I keep repeating. Never, ever forget the state is different. States have their own administrative procedure acts. Texas has its own administrative procedure act. As a result, things that might be done under informal rulemaking on the federal level might be done with a full-fledged trial-type proceeding in a state. Texas is a perfect example of this. In Texas, certain types of permits that on the federal level, you just do a notice and comment, actually require a full adversarial trial-type hearing with an ALJ, parties representing, record, submittal of evidence, cross-examination, oral testimony, and then appeal. Many lawyers make their living on the fact that Texas provides for contested hearings. So never forget, don't assume the federal answer is the state answer. You've always got to pull up the state statute. So with that in mind, we've talked about formal rulemaking. Let's talk now about informal rulemaking. And once again, to sort of highlight the issue, the books have given us a useful case. And here it's the U.S. versus Nova Scotia food products case, which is interesting, one of the rare times we don't have a U.S. Supreme Court case. There's a reason. This is actually one of those cases worth knowing by name. It comes up repeatedly. So flag it in your outlines. And here's the, I'll restrain my urge to dive into it and turn to Julia if you could. Would you give us a quick rundown of what this case is about? Who's still awake on this side of the room now? I admit, reading this case the first time for me was an exercise of endurance. But keep going. Yeah, I will pause. Botulism makes this case interesting in one respect. Botulism, I guess it's still pretty much untreatable at this point. If you get it, you're dead. And it's a gruesome way to die. Anyway, I'll stop without the details, but let's keep going. Such a nice way to put it. They turn to mush.
Yeah.
Basically, if you bake the whitefish, they turn into gruel.
Right.
No one will buy them. Okay.
So they decided that they were just going to kind of ignore it because they had submitted comments to the proposed rulemaking, but I guess they ignored the comments pretty much. And so that's kind of the basis of this case, is whether or not they went.
Can I pause for a second? The object of today's class, make sure we're on the same page. What is notice and comment rulemaking? Can you describe that?
Sure. It's like the informal rulemaking that you're talking about. It lays out in section 553 the process to go through in order to, make a regulation, a rule. And then the process that an agency goes through to make rules.
Okay. So, if it's an informal notice of comment rulemaking, what is, again, describe roughly what that process is like.
Sure. Well, the book says that the agency has to file a notice in the Federal Registrar proposing to take certain action, providing background data and information about why they're initiating this regulation. Mm-hmm. And then they establish a period in which interested members of the public, or in this case, the fish industry, they respond with comments.
Okay. And then?
Then the agency's final rule addresses the comments and either incorporates them or usually acknowledges what they said, maybe why they didn't incorporate them.
Okay. And that's it?
Okay.
Okay. So no actual public hearing, no type of oral testimony, no third-party adjudicator. The agency makes the call, and it's all a paper exercise. Okay? All right, I'll come back to this in a minute, but let's keep going. You've captured the essence of it. It's informal in many ways.
Sure. So when the proposed regulation came out, several of the prominent subdivision companies or whatever wrote comments saying that there was no, they didn't lay out any alternatives for them to follow. So the, like Nova Scotia, they said that it should be done like species by species, or they should acknowledge that maybe certain fish don't carry the botulism as common as others do. And so I guess the commissioner did not consider suggestions or acknowledge a feasible alternative that was commercially viable for the
So I just published the rule, and it's as if they never submitted any paper at all. No response, nothing.
Right. They didn't even address. They didn't have a, I guess they, the issue was that there wasn't like an adequate record stating a different.
So what did the Second Circuit say in light of that?
They said that since they didn't address the, it was arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion, not in accordance to the law, because there was no whole record. They couldn't go look at the data and say, oh, okay, well, this makes sense. Why, you know, there's botulism in every fish, but when they went to look at the history of the whitefish, there was no, I mean, there was like 8 cases of it, but it was like a different process that they used in the past.
So, given that, is the Second Circuit saying that they got it wrong?
Well, I think that they were just saying it was like a procedural issue.
Okay.
But there was no, they needed to make the data readily available, so then the different, whatever, companies could be like, well, this doesn't make sense because my fish, the fish that we smoke, doesn't cause botulism or whatever.
All right, well, suppose the FDA commissioner submitted an affidavit or testified live with the Second Circuit. We got it, we considered it, here's what we thought, here's why we didn't incorporate it.
Okay, well, I guess the issue was that they didn't make the, there was an average, like, the data wasn't made available to
the Okay. So, if you do it in the final rule, basically you make a decision before the other companies have a chance to respond to it.
Right, yeah, there's no.
So, why can't the commissioner just tell the Second Circuit what he was thinking, or she was thinking?
Because
it would have been him at that time.
Because there has to be a whole, there has to be like this, I guess, disclosure to all interested parties about the reasons why.
Uh-huh. Why? Is it a constitutional value?
They said, I don't remember.
Now, I can sort of give a cheat here.
Sure.
Anytime I say a constitutional value for the last month of class, it usually means it's a red herring. This is all regulatory practice. So while I will touch on constitutional issues, it's not going to be the driver for a lot of our discussion. Basically, this is how to interpret the Administrative Procedure.
Yeah, I think the purpose of this case was just to show that there are procedural issues with the notice and comment that they can arise.
Well, and it's, and if you don't mind, I'll sort of counsel a bit. So you told us who won, you told us the operative principle that's involved in the decision, you give us some facets as to how it might play out. Let me elaborate a little bit. You can tell me if I'm sort of running too far with this. This case actually encapsulates, and if you unpack it, carries a lot of fundamental concepts that are going to shape everything we're going to talk about the rest of this month. Notice, number one, it lays out the rudiments of the notice and comment process itself. And this is very much bare bones. There's actual multiple steps that can interleaf with each of these. It can be much more elaborate. It can last much longer. But the bottom line is, under the Administrative Procedure Act for informal notice and comment rulemaking, You have notice by the agency of a proposed rule that's published in the Federal Register. Required, it must be in the Federal Register. It can't be just put up on the website. There is then a comment period, which has to be long enough to allow parties, the public, to submit comments. And those comments from the public become part of the administrative record. This is not a choice tossed phrase. It's vitally important to the process we're talking about. Because just like a trial record going up for appeal, the administrative record is it. This is the sum total of knowledge that the agency relies upon in making a decision that is going to lead to the final regulation. The agency does all this review process internally. This is external. This is in the light of public day. This is something the agency does not have to do in the light of the public. Matter of fact, if you submit a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request for these information on consideration of rules, you can't get it. It's internal to the agency, deliberative process for rules and process. This is something the agency keeps close to itself. Once it's gone through the process of reviewing and integrating its responses to those rule comments, you come up with a final rule. That's it. Seems fairly straightforward, doesn't it? But it sort of opens the door to some interesting questions. This case talks about not only what is a record, but also is it automatically legal to get a comment that you fail to respond to? Is that inherent, arbitrary and capricious? Let me pause here. Separate from this process, this case also highlights the initial standard judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. And essentially, for informal rulemaking is arbitrary, capricious, or otherwise not in accordance with law. You're going to hear arbitrary and capricious so much, it will make the back of your neck crawl to hear it again tonight. I assume you've heard arbitrary and capricious subject to this standard in your other classes as well. And for the record, I see almost everybody nodding their heads a little bit, yes. This is coin of the realm. This is a deferential standard of review that every agency hungers for. It's their trump card. If you can be under arbitrary and capricious standard review, essentially the court will let you promote your rule, even if they think it's wrong. As long as it's not so wrong that it's arbitrary, irrational, and capricious. As a result, this process gets you that trump card. That's why the informal process is so important. Having said that, think about some of the logical problems this process creates. For one, what happens if you get a substantive major comment here and you incorporate it into your final rule, but it changes the rule so much that people basically are going to be surprised by it? Do you have to repropose the rule? Do you have to sort of go through an infinite regress? You keep reproposing every time a major comment comes in. Second, think like lawyers. How do you game this system? If you wanted to have an agency come in your way, and you know the proposal is going to create a record that is the sole basis for its decision, how do you sink your hands into the steaming guts of that process and manipulate it so that it benefits your client? I'll pause here. What idea comes to mind immediately, real quickly? Anything?
Comments.
I'm sorry, who said?
Sir? A lot of comments.
A lot of comments?
Yeah.
So volume matters? All right. I'll simply say, absolutely.
Well, I'm a CPA, so we go through this a lot with the PCAOB. Anytime they want to issue a new
You guys not going to call you for the rest of the semester. Okay, keep going.
Anytime they want to make a new standard, they have to open the white paper, they issue the white papers, and then we submit any comments we want. So in practice, we usually have like a rules partner who actually reads every single thing that the PCAOB puts out. And if any of it applies to our client, we basically get together and we figure out where do we want this to guide our client and how can we get there with the comments that we make. problem with these agencies is they usually only have a couple people actually making the rule. So when you flood them with comments, they have to respond to that comment, and they have to research like a basis for why they can do what they want to do to that comment. So it just bogs them down and it takes forever.
Yeah. So not only is it manipulation of the process to submit comments that the agency has to respond to, and to submit a lot of them, I'll simply say I'm working on one rule right now where we've had over 5 million comments submitted. The very fact you submit that many comments may affect whether or not it's arbitrary and capricious, whether the standard is, again, but also the very response to it. The process of compiling those responses can gum up an agency for years. And if you're representing someone who's fine with that, that's not a bad tactical way to use. Anything else? All right. Let me suggest a few other things to think about then. This is a proposal of a rule. This whole process only applies if you're talking about a rule. What happens if the agency says, take this cup away from me? I don't want to go through this notice and comment. It's excruciating. What if this wasn't a rule? We're going to call it guidance. We're going to call it an interpretive document. This may have important effects, but it's not a quote rule, close quote. Keep that in mind. That's our coming up in our next class reading, which I've assigned. Again, the Supreme Court has been incredibly accommodating and giving us another major case on exactly that issue just last month. Second, one other comment as well. Again, as an advocate, who gets to file a lawsuit challenging a rule based on comments? Can you file a lawsuit based on someone else's comments? Think about that. I will simply say I've had the odd position of people offering to literally buy one of my clients simply so that they could step into the shoes of my client and take over their comments in a rule proceeding because they didn't want to risk that issue. So with that in mind, takeaways for today before we leave, and you can enjoy the beautiful sunshine outside. We're talking about regulatory process. We've talked about the Administrative Procedure Act. We've talked about the difference between formal and informal rulemaking. And we've opened the door, the first glimpse, of what deferential standard review the courts are going to apply to agencies. We're going to talk a little bit more about what is a rulemaking in the next class, and we'll start working our way through very specific detail the standard as we get to the later part of the class. Any questions before we break? Otherwise, Professor Kumar will turn out the lights and assist me leave. Okay, with that, thanks much. See you on Wednesday.